And we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. A very busy week. But not a lot on the local scene, apparently, according to you two. but there was something. So talk about some city politicians.
Supporting the legalization of marijuana, yes. City politicians went down to the state legislature this week to testify on behalf of House Bill 1550, which is stuck in committee. It's the companion bill to the Senate bill that passed for the legalization of marijuana in the state of Washington. And the city officials that testified included City Council Member Tim Burgess, who I think we talked about last week. He's the head of the Public Safety Committee. He's a former cop. And he oversees the guy who heads the Public Safety Committee at the City Council that oversees the Seattle Police Department. He came out last week and said, we should legalize marijuana. He went down to testify in the House, and City Attorney Pete Holmes, and also to a lot of people's surprise, former U.S. Attorney John McKay joined up with them and went down. I think that's very interesting. Holmes said that Seattle could collect up to $1 million in taxes if marijuana were legalized. And Pete Holmes also said that the city's already saving a lot of money on enforcement since voters made it the lowest law enforcement priority in the city. And since the police department has made it its lowest law enforcement priority, violent crime in the city has actually gone down, hasn't been going up as it has in other parts of the state. And then also this week, the city sent a letter to the legislature in support of the Senate Bill 5073, signed by the mayor and all 9 council members and the city attorney, which I found really interesting because when else do you ever see the city council agreeing with the mayor and on paper?
All 9 members of the city
all
council.
All 9 members, yeah. Which is very interesting. I don't think all 9 of them have come out in favor of this before.
Yeah, they're on the same page.
I don't think all 9 of them and the mayor would come out in favor in a united front of, puppies and kittens.
But when it comes to pot, yes.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that would have brought everybody together? But uh-huh. All right. So anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. So then we're moving on to national and developments. This week, starting with Wisconsin.
Yeah, a judge issued a restraining order yesterday prohibiting the state from enforcing the bill that was recently passed by the Republican state legislature and signed by Governor Walker that essentially made it impossible for state employee unions to negotiate contracts, and actually did a number of other things as well, including outsourcing and privatizing a number of the state's resources. The judge in the case ruling that they can't enforce that. It may or may not actually result in the court case moving forward ruling against the state. That's still up in the air, but it does for the time being put it on hold and gives people more time to organize against it. And it also lessens the time, even if it does pass, between any implementation of the bill and the recall effort that's going underway, which in the case of Governor Walker is not eligible until he's been in office for a year.
Interesting. All right. Anything else on Wisconsin?
Nope. Let's move along.
All right.
We had a lot going on this week.
Yeah. There was a resignation this week at the State Department.
Yeah. State Department spokesman Philip J. Crowley resigned his job this week. That's after he criticized the Pentagon for its handling of Private First Class Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning, as you may remember, is accused of leaking the cables to WikiLeaks that caused such an uproar earlier this year. Crowley called the Pentagon's treatment of Manning, quote, ridiculous and counterproductive and stupid, end quote. This was when he was talking to a few people at MIT just in the past week or so. Crowley has spent most of the last few months handling the press's questions about the WikiLeaks cables, trying to do damage control for the Obama administration.
Because the latest release of cables was State Department cables, which is why he was so central to the case.
He was very central to that. And And he's coming out against the treatment of Manning. Basically, you know, this is a guy who knows what the impact, you would think this is the guy who would know what the impact of the cables has been on the State Department and on the U.S. government. And he's saying the fact that they're treating Manning like he's a terrorism suspect is ridiculous.
Yeah. Although bear in mind that even after Crowley resigned, President Obama has reiterated that he thinks Manning's treatment is appropriate.
Yes.
This the same Obama who, as a candidate in 2007-2008, came out very strongly against torture, which is how a lot of people are categorizing Manning's treatment.
And pledged to close Guantanamo. Of course, that hasn't happened.
Well, I think it's a long list of things that hasn't happened. We don't have time for all that.
For all that.
In the next 20-some minutes. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Let's move on to Operation Sock Puppet.
Well, I don't think that's the official name for it, but The Guardian in the UK reporting this week that the U.S. has contracted with a California firm for software for sock puppets for Facebook, Twitter, and social media. This being a case where a $2.76 million contract awarded to something called the Intrepid Corporation to enable U.S. service personnel, that is people in the military, to operate up to 10 different false identities. Now, CENTCOM
online identities.
Now, CENTCOM is the military agency that has responsibility for all of its operations in the Middle East and Central Asia. So it's overseeing both our troop presence in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, as well as operations in other Middle East countries. And of course, there's a lot going on in the Middle East right now. There are a number of problems with this. Although, curiously enough, even though The Guardian reported it, there was virtually no reporting of it in U.S. media. One of the things that you can note from it is that this is probably already happening. Note that this is software that automates the process and makes it easier for the military to do it. That implies that the military has already been doing it because, of course, you can set up false identities and sock puppetry very easily on blogs or on social media. It's just somewhat time-consuming because you have to actually monitor the publications, and you actually have to, you know, send the stuff out. That's number one. Second is this is not just a breach of internet etiquette. It's actually a crime because the U.S. is prohibited and intelligence agencies and the militaries are prohibited from propagandizing U.S. citizens. And as people who have tried the connection of tubes that is the internets may be aware, internets don't respect international boundaries. There are people in the United States who are reading Middle Eastern blogs all the time, particularly given that we have such an interest in the Middle East these days. And third, of course, is that it's particularly notable that it was British media that was reporting this and not U.S. media.
Yeah, and the Pentagon said that that this operation wouldn't be targeted against U.S. citizens, and they said the way that they would ensure that is that they would not be conducting any of this propaganda in English, which is racist and completely ignorant of the multilingual character of the American people. And as Jobs said, the fact that many people in the U.S. are interested in Middle Eastern affairs and do have the ability to read and monitor what's going on in media and in blog posts from Middle Eastern countries.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, the TSA... this week, discovering they might have made an error.
Yeah, the Transportation Safety Administration, which has responsibility for, as folks who do air travel are probably painfully aware, for monitoring who gets on airplanes and how they get on airplanes, as we've discussed on this program before, has instituted body scanners, full-size body scanners with X-rays in a number of airports around the country, at least 78 airports, including SeaTac. They discovered this week that the 500-plus body scanners that they implemented they made a calculation error, that's what they call it, in their safety studies, and that the radiation levels are actually 10 times what they thought they were. Now, the TSA hastened to reassure people that even though the radiation levels were 10 times what they had previously expected, and even though when they were one-tenth what they thought they were, a lot of people had safety concerns, that the machines still met all safety standards and would remain in operation. So if you are going on a red eye, maybe, and flying at night, you can rest secure in the knowledge that you'll be glowing for some time after you get on the plane, and visibility will not be a problem.
Yeah, you will truly have red eyes.
and many of them.
Yeah, I mean, they don't have to worry anymore, I guess, about scanning planes from landing from Japan because, you know, I mean, whether you get the radiation flying over Japan or the radiation going through the body scanners, it's all going to register the same, I guess.
Mm. All right. Moving on to international and starting with Bahrain.
Yeah, in Bahrain, on Monday, Saudi troops invaded Bahrain in order to support the royal family against the nation's citizenry. At the same time, Hillary Clinton, making a stop in her tour of the Middle East, pledged to give the king of Bahrain $10 billion over 10 years in military aid and other support. And then the next day, the Bahraini government declared martial law. On Wednesday, Bahrain's military and police cracked down hard on citizens occupying Pearl Square, who have been occupying Pearl Square for over a month.
In fact, they took down the Pearl in Pearl Square.
Yeah, by Friday they began to dismantle the monument. That's really the message of repression here, is that you can't even have a symbol of freedom. That's not just the government of Bahrain. They wouldn't have been able to do that on their own, and they needed the support of the Saudi military and of the U.S. military in order to do that. That's the message that we are supporting in the Middle East right now.
Bear in mind that the Fifth Fleet of the United States, which is a critical military asset for the U.S., is based in Bahrain. So it's a really important military asset to that alliance is. All out of proportion to the actual size of the country.
Yeah, and we should also keep in mind, too, that the actions on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday in Bahrain, the total repression of the freedom movement in Bahrain has led to a reinvigoration of protest movements throughout the Middle East. There were massive protests in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq, and in other areas of the Middle East. And the protesters in the street were not only calling for the overthrow of their own governments, but they were calling for resistance, and they were saying, Saudi Arabia, if you can invade Bahrain, why aren't you helping us? Why are you helping the government?
Wait a minute. Why would there be protests in Iraq? Didn't we institute a democracy in Iraq?
That's a good joke. Job.
No, I'm asking the question because that's what I keep hearing.
Nouri al-Maliki, he was defeated in the election but has not allowed the party that won elections in Iraq to take power. In addition, he set up what he said was a coalition government sharing power with the winning party. However, the head of the winning party has withdrawn support from his government. And Maliki has refused to appoint new cabinet ministers for the position of the Interior Ministry and the Ministry of Defense. In other words, he retains control of the military and of the state police in his own hands, which are classic signs of a dictatorship. So clearly in Iraq, what's happened is we have replaced one tyrant with another.
Forgive me if you stated this when you were talking about Bahrain, but I thought it was interesting that the crackdown there occurred, did you say it happened like the day after Hillary Clinton left?
Well, Hillary was there on Monday, and the day that Saudi troops rolled in and she pledged support, military and other financial support to the king of Bahrain,
$10 billion.
The next day, the government of Bahrain declared martial law, and then the day after that, they rolled troops into Pearl Square and started to crack down hard on the demonstrators.
And Clinton was in Saudi Arabia before she was in Bahrain, so it's pretty clear that all this was done with the approval of the United States,
with the help of the United States. Yeah, and I want to point out too that this was no tear gas and rubber bullets crackdown. There was live ammunition, dead people everywhere. They burned the encampment that protesters had set up in Pearl Square, similar to the encampment in Egypt in Tahrir Square. It was pretty brutal crackdown.
Okay, so and then moving on to Libya, it appears the U.S. stance there is somewhat different.
Is somewhat different, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We've actually gone to war in Libya, although nobody wants to call it that. In fact, President Barack Obama and other administration officials are going to pains to say this is a temporary engagement which other people will be taking the lead on. What happened is the United States Security Council voted 10-0 with 5 abstentions to authorize a no-fly zone in Libya for the rationale of humanitarian intervention as Gaddafi's forces bore down on the last strongholds of the rebellion in Benghazi and other East Libyan cities over the past week. So this intervention really comes just in time for those folks. And in fact, within hours of the passage of the UN no-fly zone resolution, Gaddafi did declare a ceasefire, which was one of the demands of the United Nations. But above and beyond that, it's very clear from the comments of not just administration officials, but also officials in Egypt and France who are taking the lead on implementing the no-fly zone, which includes using United States planes and technology to take out Libya's air defense systems first as a way to make sure that the no-fly zone can be enforced. It's very clear that the goal here is not humanitarian intervention. It is, in fact, regime change, that's got to be the end game. But, of course, it's not an end game because after Gaddafi is removed from office, The question then becomes, then what? Because Libya is a tribal society. It's a society in which the resistance, such as it's been over the past couple of weeks, has been very fractured, been very leaderless, and has had a lot of internal contradictions as well. So nobody really knows, after 40 years of repression of civil society, who would take over in Libya if Gaddafi and his family are gone. So there's a real question of if the United States gets involved in this and if other Western powers get involved in this, and particularly with the prospect of Libya as an oil-producing country, what exactly is the endgame in this? Is this a commitment for an ongoing military involvement in Libya and actually running the country or installing a pro-Western government in Libya that would be just as repressive as the one that it is replacing? So it's really not at all clear what the objectives are in this. We do know one thing: the objectives certainly are not the preservation of human life, because as we're seeing in Bahrain and other places, that's a very selective priority on behalf of the American administration of Obama and other Western governments as well.
Yeah, I see it from a slightly different perspective. I see that I see it from the perspective of, here you had the rebels begging for help. Essentially asking multiple times, we need a no-fly zone, we need a no-fly zone, they're crushing us, you know, Gaddafi's crushing us, you need to help us. And and earlier this week, last weekend, the Arab League came out and said, yes, we support imposing a no-fly zone. They didn't step forward and say, we will impose a no-fly zone. They didn't commit troops and didn't commit planes.
And the UN resolution probably would not have happened without the Arab League doing that.
Right, right. And then following that, the UN resolution came. But the UN resolution came because the U.S. finally said, okay, we support this. And then U.S. personnel at the UN started lobbying for it, a no-fly zone. And so, as Jobs said, there is that issue of, what do you do when Gaddafi has repressed all other aspects of civil society, you know, and it's not clear who would lead the country. On the other hand, do we support democratic values? The U.S. has to, you know, the U.S. has to occasionally follow through on that rhetoric. And that's what's going on in Libya. At the same time, we have the U.S. supporting the side of repression in places like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, which has also cracked down hard on its own protesters in a very brutal way. And so that sends mixed messages to the Middle East. You know, we occasionally support our rhetoric when it suits us. Otherwise, we support our interests. In the case of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, we have a very direct financial interest in those in those nations.
And we don't have much in the way of financial or military interests in Libya, which is why we can afford
to do that, to take the luxury to support our rhetoric of, yes, we support democracy in Libya.
All right. Well, another place that we've never sent mixed messages to had major developments this week, Haiti.
Yeah, in Haiti, the return of Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
I don't think we've ever sent mixed messages there, have we? We've always supported depression.
Oh, I don't know. I think we've sent mixed messages to Aristide himself many times when he was initially running for president in the early 1990s. I remember the U.S. was very opposed to a champion of the poor leading a nation that is mostly populated by very, very poor citizens.
That's never changed, though, has it? It's been consistent.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Well, the U.S. has at times given support to Aristide and at other times pushed him out. Aristide himself is a problematic figure, having helped the poor on many occasions, but also his regime has in the past given in to corruption, which is the temptation of power, a very difficult temptation for anyone to resist.
Especially in such a poor country.
Yeah, especially in a poor country. Where the aid dollars flow very freely. He returned to Haiti on a day that was the last day of campaigning for the current presidential election there. There are two candidates in the election there. We haven't covered this a whole lot on the air, so I'm going to take a minute or so to talk about it. Merland Manigat is a former first lady. She has a lot of support from the West and from the U.S. right now. They would love to see her win. On the other hand, a sort of new version of Aristide, one a less problematic figure, is Michel Martelly. He's a very popular singer there, an artist, someone who has a lot of support of the youth, of folks who are into the cultural scene, and also of the poor, who see him as a counterweight to Manigat, who has the support of the U.S. and of the business community.
And how is the earthquake and the effort to rebuild from that last year, how has that affected the election?
And that's affected it a lot. There are a lot more people supporting Martelly now because that they've really seen how the West and the business community have failed to help Haiti in any real way recover from the earthquake. And they see him as a new beginning. So the fact that Aristide came back on the last day of campaigning, that's been a problem for the U.S. They're worried that he's going to try to take over. However, a lot of the folks who are going to vote in the election, they've just kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, Aristide is the past. Martelly is our future.
All right. Well, then that leaves us about 6 minutes left to talk about Japan.
Yeah, about what's going on at Fukushima. It is worse than what we've been hearing. And you can...
I'm shocked. Shocked I am.
And you can tell that when you listen to the coverage, when they're interviewing multiple different physicists trying to get some idea of what the outcome might be of what's going on at the plant, and you get a very wide variation in their responses. And at the end of their response, they always say, "We just don't know." And that's because we really are in unknown territory with this disaster. Chernobyl, I want to point out that the media has made comparisons to Chernobyl, but Chernobyl was one problem with one reactor at the Daiichi plant in Fukushima. There are six reactors and seven pools of highly radioactive spent fuel rods, which are not under any kind of containment right now. It's almost guaranteed that most of the radiation coming from the plant right now is coming from those pools of spent fuel rods. There is no equipment left after the explosions, after the earthquake and the tsunami and the explosions of the plant. There's no equipment left inside the building to tell them what's going on in there, and the radiation levels are too high for any personnel to be inside the plant. So we are on truly uncharted territory when it comes to talking about what is actually happening there right now and what the future might be and what the levels of radiation might be. But I also want to point out, too, that right now a lot of blame is being assigned here. You know, whose fault is it that this happened and who, you know, should take care of it? And I just want to say, you know, this is no longer only Japan's problem. This is the world's problem. And it really irritates me to see that people are not coming together, that the world's leaders are not coming together. and saying we have to draw up a plan and do something about this. And it can't just be a plan for the next 7 days. It has to be a plan for the next 7 years, because that's how long or it's going to take to clean this up, or probably a lot longer.
1,000 years, yeah.
Yeah.
The IAEA was saying in 2008 that Japan's nuclear safety guidelines were dangerously out of date, and a whistleblower was quoted in a WikiLeaks cable that the Japanese ministry was covering up nuclear accidents and obscuring the true costs and problems associated with the nuclear industry. There's been a lot of anger in Japan itself over the sort of lax supervision of the nuclear plants, but let's be very clear about this. It's very easy to blame the Japanese government in this case, but this is endemic to nuclear power, because, you know, when it is operating properly, nuclear power is safe. The problem is that it's operated by human beings, and human beings are not perfect creatures. We make mistakes. We make mistakes that compound previous mistakes, and, you know, sometimes that cuts through all of the fail-safes and all of the guarding against this type of incident, whereas, you know, even though in a perfect world the technology can work perfectly, it's not a perfect world, and when it does have an accident like this, the results can be catastrophic. And the upshot of this is that nuclear power does not work, not because it can't work most of the time, but because that percent of the time there's a guarantee that it will not work properly, and when it doesn't work properly, the results are the kind of catastrophe that we're seeing this week.
Yeah, in fact, I was on the bus this week, and I heard a couple of guys talking, and one of them asked the other, why can't they just turn it off? You know, just turn off the off switch. And I wanted to say something, but I didn't. What I wanted to say was the plants are off. That happened when the earthquake hit. The chain reaction was turned off almost immediately. The problem is the nature of nuclear fuel. You can turn off the chain reaction. You cannot turn off radioactive decay. That's the nature of nuclear fuel. That's the nature of uranium. That's the nature of what goes into these plants. You can only try to contain it and keep it cool so that it doesn't get thousands of degrees hotter than it is and set off melting and fires and radioactive pollution in the environment. And that's the problem that's going on at the Daiichi plant, is that containment's been breached on at least one reactor, and they have these open pools of spent fuel rods that are not under containment, and the cooling systems have failed. That's, as Job said, the nature of nuclear power, is that you can turn off the chain reaction. You cannot turn off the radioactive decay.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
No, and, you know, I just want to say I want to see President Obama meet with Angela Merkel, meet with the Prime Minister of Japan and other leading nuclear nations like the President of China, Hu Jintao. I want to see them get together and say, we are putting together a plan to deal with this worldwide disaster, because that is what it is.
Yeah, during this whole time, President Obama has been vocally saying that, you know, going to stick to the plan of with the U.S. nuclear plants that are all 105
yeah.
of them are.
That's
are
not
way...
going to happen, because they're not going to be able to get insurance on those plants. I can tell you
now.
Right now.
Yeah.
All right. Events.
Yeah. This week is the 8th anniversary of the invasion and then occupation of Iraq. And as a result, there will be a commemorative protest because of, as we alluded to earlier in the program, that hasn't worked out so well for the people of Iraq, both in the past and as we speak. So that'll be at noon today, Saturday. It'll be a rally at noon and a 1 o'clock a march that'll be happening at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle, 4th and Pine. Go down there and show up and voice your support for democracy in Iraq, because it would still be an excellent idea.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. It's all one word, and it's all one site where you can find a blog, you can find comics, you can find articles, and all kinds of interesting stuff on local and national and international affairs. So check it out, eatthestate.org.